This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President-elect Barack Obama has to deal with the greatest economic crisis our country has faced since the Depression. My guest Robert Kuttner is the author of the new book, Obama's Challenge, America's Economic Crisis and the Power of a Transformative Presidency. Kuttner is not an advisor or consultant to Obama. His book is more of an open letter, analyzing the economic crisis and suggesting strategies to deal with it, drawing on the legacies of presidents Kuttner considers to have been transformational, such as FDR, LBJ, and Ronald Reagan. Kuttner is an economics writer. He co-founded and co-edits the magazine The American Prospect. He's previously been a columnist for Business Week, economics editor of The New Republic, and chief investigator of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee. Robert Kuttner, welcome back to Fresh Air. And I think I should say congratulations to you on Obama winning, because if he didn't win, your book would have a very short shelf life.
It would be a historical curiosity.
Yes. So you were obviously banking on him winning when you wrote this book. Now, you're not neutral in your book. So before we get going, I'd like you to just spell out where you're coming from, what your economic overview is.
I took a close look at Obama and decided in my own mind that he was the one candidate who was potentially a transformational president. And I took this gamble of writing the book before he'd won the election and predicting the crash before the crash happened, and assuming that because there would be a crash, which would both be a financial challenge but also a discrediting of the ideology that brought the crash, Obama would have an extraordinary opportunity to lead the country in a different direction. During the campaign, for reasons that I think are pretty obvious politically, he was not as far-reaching as I think he's going to need to be as president because of the seriousness of the crisis. He was the man who would be post-partisan, post-ideology. A lot of his Chicago friends call him incremental in his thinking, very pragmatic. I think the same way Roosevelt did and Lincoln did, he is going to have to grow into a much bolder president, and I think it is within his character to do so. And I think the economic situation will require him to do so if he is not to fail.
He ran a campaign that was based on the principle of holding people together and not dividing the country, and one would assume he'd want to go into the presidency taking counsel from all sides and proceeding from there.
One of his great strengths, and this has something to do with his character, it's also reminiscent of Lincoln, if that's not too much of a stretch, is he has the self-confidence and the intellect to listen to a lot of different people who disagree with each other. Roosevelt also did this. And then come to a decision and then ask the people whose advice he agrees with to take the ball and run with it. I think the idea that you are either a unifier or a progressive, I think, is a false dichotomy, if you will, in the sense that if you look at Roosevelt or Lincoln or the Johnson of the Civil Rights era, they governed as radical reformers, but they were also great unifiers. And so the challenge here is to define a new consensus that is necessitated by the circumstances that Obama inherits and lead people to it and encourage the people to put pressure on him to succeed. So I think this is going to evolve fairly quickly. That is, if it becomes necessary to spend $700 billion on a bank bailout, as it has been done under a Republican administration, it's a whole new day. And I think if it becomes necessary to spend several hundred billions more every year to keep a financial crash from triggering Great Depression II, that will become the new consensus. Now, is that bridging differences or is that leading as a progressive? Well, I think it's both.
I'll just say, when you mentioned President Johnson as a uniter, you weren't talking about the war in Vietnam.
No, on the contrary. I mean, yeah. There are two Lyndon Johnsons here, and the tragedy is that until the war ruined his presidency, he was the greatest president since Roosevelt. He had accomplished the legislation of much of the unfinished business of the New Deal, plus the three great civil rights acts, and that took not just legislative craft, which Johnson was famous for, of course, but it took leadership with the people.
Now, Obama has to pick a Treasury Secretary, and that is expected to happen very soon. They will inherit a lot of the financial crisis. How much power will a new Treasury Secretary have to modify the plan that the current Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, and Congress came up with?
A huge amount, because in bargaining with the administration to get this plan through Congress, the Democratic leadership in Congress had to give Paulson a lot of discretionary authority, and they do not like the way he is using it. Two examples. The banks are refusing to lend because they're so traumatized by conditions in the markets. The banks are going on paying dividends even as they are refusing to lend, and some of the banks are giving their executives large bonuses. The administration takes the line that if you try to prevent them from paying dividends, you're going to scare off private capital. We need private capital. So the administration is playing very gently with the banks. The administration is also not putting too much pressure on banks and savings institutions to refinance distressed mortgages. They're leaving that up to the private sector. The Democrats in Congress are very unhappy with this. I assume President Obama will be very unhappy with this, and you will either get a revision in the legislation, or you will get a very different use of the legislation by Obama's appointees at Treasury.
Why are many Democratic members of Congress unhappy with how the $124 billion that has been given to, what is it, 24
banks?
Yeah, why are they unhappy with how it's being used? They wanted it to be used for loosening up credit, for making loans, and you say it's being used for raises and to pay dividends to shareholders.
Well, let me be clear. It's not exclusively being used for dividends, but they are continuing to pay out dividends. It's not being—
Don't they have to do that? Don't they have to continue to pay
out
dividends?
No. When you buy shares in a company, whether you get your dividend is simply a function of whether the company's making money. Mm-hmm. And under normal circumstances, when the company's having a losing year, it would be perfectly normal to suspend dividend payments. It happens all the time. It's not like an interest payment. It's not contractual the way an interest payment on a bond is. And yet they're afraid, since their stock price has taken such a hit, that if they suspend dividends, it'll take even more of a hit. But the point is, Congress did not pass this legislation so that banks could continue paying dividends. It passed this legislation so that banks would restart lending. But having erred on the side of being too loose in their standards, now they're erring on the side of being too tight, and Paulson's being very gentle with them. So the congressional leadership is not happy with the way Paulson is running this, for the reason that it is not achieving the goals that they set out to achieve when they did this extraordinary act of bailing out the banks to the tune of several $100 billion of taxpayer money. And I do think Obama's people will handle this differently. But I must say there are divisions among different people within the Obama camp. Some of the veterans of the Clinton administration would take an approach similar to Paulson's, like Larry Summers. And other people who have been mentioned, I think, would take a somewhat tougher approach.
Now, Larry Summers is one of the people that seems to be high on the list as a possible Treasury Secretary. You say you think he'd be likely to continue the Paulson policy.
Well, he'd be closer to the Paulson policy. I mean, there are a couple of big positives with Summers and a couple of big negatives. He's obviously very smart, and as the Summers advocates like to say, he knows his way around the building. He's been Treasury Secretary before in the last 2 years of the Clinton administration. The negatives are that his views are too much like the views that helped bring us the crisis. He was a big deregulator when he was Treasury Secretary. A lot of things that looked like they were smart policy in the 90s but turned out to not be so smart.
So if Larry Summers represents one point of view within the Democratic Party, what are some of the other points of view, and who are the candidates for Treasury Secretary who represent those points of view?
I think the three most interesting candidates are Tim Geithner, who's the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. That's the bank that walks point when a Lehman Brothers is at risk of going under. And he's generally credited with doing a good job. He is somewhat more inclined, I think, to be a tough regulator than Summers, and he has admirers all over the political spectrum, ranging from Barney Frank to Pete Peterson, the former Commerce Secretary under Nixon, who's the huge advocate of cutting back entitlements. He's a civil servant rather than somebody who made a lot of money on Wall Street. Another name that you hear, who's the person who I admire most, is Sheila Bair. She's the head of the FDIC. She has run the FDIC as an absolute model agency. When she takes over a bank, she goes in and takes it over. She doesn't just throw money at it. And she's also used the banks that she's taken over, like IndyMac in California, to proactively refinance mortgages so that people are spared the heartbreak of foreclosure. And she's been the toughest of all of the regulators currently in office. And the marvelous thing is she's a Republican. So if Obama appointed Sheila Bair, he'd get a woman, he'd get a Republican, he'd get a tough regulator, he'd get a clean break. The other name you hear is John Corzine, governor of New Jersey. He's terrific. The problem is the Goldman Sachs dynasty would continue. Rubin came out of Goldman. He was Treasury Secretary. Paulson came out of Goldman. And I don't think the Obama administration, as much as they might like John Corzine personally and respect his skills, would dare to appoint a third Goldman alum in a row.
So when the new Treasury Secretary does take over, would there need to be new legislation for the new Treasury Secretary to modify the way the bailout is being handled now, the bailout of the banks?
Well, there are two issues here. One is recapitalizing or bailing out the banks. The other is putting a floor under collapsing housing prices, which I think is the single most serious thing that's going on that's dragging the economy into a deeper recession. On the question of recapitalizing banks, they could use the existing law more or less as it stands in a very different way. But there's a whole other agenda having to do with the need to re-regulate banks and regulate non-banks that act like banks, so that we don't get into this cycle of financial bubbles that then require taxpayer bailouts after the bubble pops all over again. That's going to require new legislation. That is not quite as urgent. But I think for the most part, they could work with the existing legislation. Now, putting a floor under housing prices and getting refinancings of distressed mortgages on the fast track, that may well require new legislation.
What are some of the options in terms of refinancing mortgages that face President-elect Obama?
Well, I think the best and cleanest way of doing it is to resurrect something that Franklin Roosevelt invented, which was called the Homeowners Loan Corporation, which used the government's own borrowing rate to refinance mortgages directly. During the Depression, after Homeowners Loan Corporation was created, the government refinanced one mortgage in five. It saved more than 1 million families from foreclosure. It was clean, it was simple, it was straightforward. Some 12,000 people worked for it at its peak. It had retail offices. It functioned like a bank. The problem with the present situation is that because subprime mortgages were sliced and diced and converted into bonds, and some collection of bondholders may have to sign off on the refinancing of your mortgage, it's like unscrambling an egg or disentangling an impossible backlash. It would be much cleaner to pass legislation, and this kind of thing has been upheld by the Supreme Court, creating the emergency right to abrogate a contract, and a mortgage is a contract, and make it clear that the bank or the homeowner's loan corp could not be sued by the bondholder if the homeowner's loan corporation modified the terms of the mortgage and required the bondholder to take less than 100 cents on the dollar in order to spare the homeowner foreclosure. That's the best way to do it. I think the second best way to do it is to put a lot more pressure on the private sector to modify the terms. The problem is this thing has gotten so hopelessly tangled up with banks no longer holding mortgages, mortgages no longer being whole but being converted into bonds that have lots of different layers of risk, that it's very difficult for a bank that no longer holds the mortgage to get the investor who ultimately does hold the bond to agree to the terms of a refinancing.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Like, no one really holds the mortgage anymore, per se. The mortgage, per se, doesn't exist. It's been chopped up into various kinds of securitizations. Is that the right word?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. And the bondholder could be anywhere.
Right.
So the clean way to fix this is to empower a homeowner's loan corporation to refinance the mortgage, send the proceeds of the refinancing off to the bondholder, pay off the bondholder at 50 or 60 cents on the dollar, and get on with it. Some of these bonds are trading at a lot less than 50 cents on the dollar. Some of these bonds are not trading at all.
Why is it in the national interest, do you think, to help homeowners who can't pay their mortgages?
Well, the problem is that when large numbers of homeowners go into default and then foreclosure, it drags down the value of housing in the neighborhood, in the city, in the country. Last time I looked, something like $2 trillion of home equity has been lost. And for the typical middle-class family, the equity that you have in your home is the largest source of accumulated wealth. People depend on this as a nest egg. And it also drags down the prices of homes when people need to sell their homes. And when people suddenly realize that the home where they thought they had $250,000 or $300,000 of equity, they only have $70,000 of equity, they tighten their belts, and you get into a classic downward spiral of reduced purchasing power, which drags down the whole economy. Now, if you can put a floor under housing prices by preventing this cycle of foreclosure, then you spare tens of millions of American families the loss of equity in their home. You spare millions of American families the tragedy of having to be foreclosed and having to lose everything in their houses. And you also create new opportunities for people to become homeowners. One of the other things a homeowners loan corporation could do would be to have a first-time mortgage, first-time homeownership program. You could take some of these abandoned properties and fix them up and have them be affordable rental housing. So I think the grand theme here is crisis can be turned into opportunity, but Obama has to be very bold in the way he proceeds.
But that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, that there are so many places that have grave financial need now, cities and states, infrastructure, you know, bank bailouts, homeowner bailouts. The auto industry wants money. I mean, there's kind of crisis in every sector. So how do you decide what your priorities are? I mean, that's going to be a really hard one for Obama, don't you think?
Well, there are two ways to look at this. There's the way that Herbert Hoover's Treasury Secretary, Andrew Mellon, looked at it. And Mellon said, liquidate everything, sell off everything. And then there's the way Roosevelt looked at it, which was to say, this is an emergency, and we have to prevent the bottom from falling out. Now, in my book, I argue that we need annual spending increases on the order of $600 billion a year. Now, that's 4 percentage points of GDP. It would raise the amount of money that the federal government spends from about 20% of the total output of the economy to about 24%. And we have had, in peacetime, spending as high as 24% of GDP before. We had it under Reagan, but most of it went for the military. I think this time you need, first of all, to prevent a single state or local employee from being laid off in a recession. You need to extend unemployment compensation. You need a lot of public infrastructure spending. The American Society of Civil Engineers estimates that there's $1.6 trillion in backlog of basic public infrastructure, things like water and sewer systems and buildings that haven't been repaired. I can see from my house, not over the Bering Straits to Russia, but I can see a bridge that hasn't been painted in decades that looks like it's going to rust out if they don't repair it. And the virtue of this is it pumps money back into the economy. It creates a lot of middle-class jobs. It gets demand flowing again. And I think, obviously, a transition to a sustainable energy economy. So there are lots of virtuous uses for public outlay that would do three good things. They would put money back into people's pockets in a classic anti-recession way. They would create a lot of middle-class jobs that can't be exported. And this is long-deferred good policy in its own right. And so I think with a working majority in Congress, Obama could do this, and he's going to need to do this in order to prevent a crash from turning into what could conceivably be a depression.
I know you've made the case for this already, but still, it's hard to fathom that with a national debt that's approaching $1 trillion, which is $1 billion dollars.
May I correct you?
Please.
It's 5.6 trillion.
All right.
You talk about the distinguished deficit from debt.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
The deficit, which is one year's budget deficit, that is not really a trillion. It's probably 700-800 billion, and then the accumulated national debt is 5.6 trillion.
It's just impossible for me to wrap my mind around numbers of that size.
Sorry.
But when you have figures that are huge like that, that are that overwhelmingly large, how do you justify spending, hundreds of billions of dollars more? Like, why does that make sense to you?
There has been a mantra in the media that the deficit and the debt are the biggest problems facing us. They're not. The risk of a depression is the biggest problem facing us. And let me put the deficit and the debt in context. Even with all of President Bush's deficit spending, and don't forget, he started from a fairly low base because Clinton handed him a surplus. Even with all of Bush's deficit spending, the accumulated national debt relative to the total gross domestic product, that's the ratio that is the all-important ratio, is just under 40%. Now, to put this in context, after World War II, it was 125%. And yet, we had a 30-year boom after World War II. So you ask the question, well, how could that be? How could a country that was saddled with debt that was greater than 1 year's output of the whole economy usher in a 30-year boom? And the answer is to look at what that debt went to buy. During World War II, we incurred this huge debt to recapitalize American industry, invest in science and technology, retrain a generation of American workers, put them back to work. We did it to win the war, but there were all kinds of spillover benefits on the civilian economy. Now, if you compare that to where we are in late 2008, the ratio of debt to gross domestic product is about 40%. It's only one-third of what it was at the end of World War II. So in order to spare the country a depression, if that ratio needs to temporarily go up to, say, 50%, even 55%, and the benefit is to get the economy back on a recovery track that much sooner, then we can get back to fiscal balance that much sooner. The alternative is to just sit there and watch the economy spiral downward and conclude that, well, we can't do anything because that would increase the deficit. I mean, I think that would be really insane.
How do we ever pay back trillions of dollars of debt?
We don't pay it back. We roll it over. And as long as the overall debt to GDP ratio is moderate, and I would certainly consider anything under about 60% of GDP to be moderate, the interest on that debt is one of the costs of doing business in the same way that the interest on my mortgage debt is one of the things that I pay for every month. As long as that doesn't overwhelm me, it enables me to live in a nice house. And I think the analogy is that as long as the interest on the debt doesn't overwhelm the economy, which it is in no danger of doing when it's down around 40 or 50% of GDP, some of that debt goes to pay for roads and bridges and science and technology and housing and training and higher education and early childhood, things that make the economy more productive. We need to have a kind of a new deal for young people, and the economy will then grow at a higher rate, and the debt will cease to be this bogeyman.
What are some of the controversies now within the Democratic Party about how much debt is justifiable and how much money spent on economic stimulus is justifiable?
Well, I think you can parse out the controversies on a number of dimensions. One, you just articulated, how much spending do we need? A related question is how much of that spending should be deficit financed and how much of it should be paid for. And my view is that most of it should be paid for. If you restored the tax code to the Clinton era, you'd get about $200 billion a year more simply by restoring taxes on the top 2% to what they used to be.
This is basically what Obama has already proposed.
Right. And, of course, the question is how much of that do you use for new spending and how much of it do you use for tax relief for more moderate-income people? One of the things that doesn't get as much attention as it should is all of the money that is left on the table because the Bush administration crippled the Internal Revenue Service. And most of that money is in tax dodges used by the top 1% that often involve moving money offshore, often involve things that are so complicated that it's difficult to tell what's legal and what's illegal. But there was a conference a few years ago of former IRS commissioners, Republican and Democrat. They all agreed that there were about $300 billion in collectible, uncollected taxes because audit resources have been shifted away from auditing the upper brackets. And you know what they've been shifted to? They have been shifted to auditing people who use the earned income tax credit, low-income wage earners. They are more likely to get audited than a multimillionaire who uses a very complicated offshore tax shelter. So I think between those two things and maybe a little bit of cut in the military, we're going to get some relief on the Iraq front, but I think much of that's going to be reprogrammed to Afghanistan. So I don't think we should hold out hope for massive savings, but maybe we could get $50 or $75 billion a year. You know, those three things plus a little bit of an increase in deficit spending gives you the kind of spending you need to prevent the crash from turning into a depression.
If you're just joining us, my guest is economics writer Robert Kuttner. He's the co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine and the author of the new book, Obama's Challenge, America's Economic Crisis and the Power of a Transformative Presidency. One of the things that you suggest in your new book is professionalizing the human service economy. Would you explain what your idea is?
You know, one of the problems that has faced so many Americans is the risk of their jobs being moved offshore. And if you think of all of the jobs taking care of America's children and taking care of America's old people and taking care of America's sick people, by definition, these are jobs that have to be close to home. There are some good jobs like public school teacher or physician in the human service sector, but there are millions and millions and millions of really bad jobs that ought to be professionalized. And I'm thinking of people who take care of very young children, people who work in child care centers for elementary school age kids, and people who work in nursing homes.
When you say bad jobs, you don't mean the work is bad. You mean the pay and the conditions are bad.
Well, that, I mean, if the if,
or
if
do
the
you
pay
mean
is
both?
Bad
I don't want to put words in your
bad,
mouth.
Right. Yeah. If the pay is bad and the conditions are bad, it's a bad job. Mm-hmm. And you look at what some other countries do. You look at what we do around the edges. Every job teaching or nurturing a preschooler ought to be a professional job. And I don't want to see a lot of people who have those jobs be laid off and replaced by people with master's degrees. I want to see them have opportunities to become professionals, to train for better credentials, and then get compensated as professionals. And there's no reason why somebody who works in a preschool should not have at least the same training and the same pay and the same career security as a kindergarten teacher. And by the way, at the other end of the age spectrum, certified nursing, CNAs, certified nurse aides, who do 95% of the hands-on care in nursing homes, they make $5, $6, $7, $8 an hour. They have very little training. The turnover rate is typically above 200%. those people could get better training. They could make more like $15 an hour. They could join the middle class. They could treat our parents and grandparents with greater professional skill. And that would be both an act of macroeconomic stimulus. It would also be an act of mercy. These are the things that we should be doing as a country. These are the things that we need to do to get out of an economic crisis. All it takes is money.
Well, yeah, all it takes is money, but I mean, it's so expensive to send in your child to daycare as it is. So if everybody's wages were raised, much as we would like to see that happen, it would make daycare even more unaffordable, to which you say what?
to which I say it should be publicly financed, the same way kindergartens are publicly financed. Sometimes I think that if the founders of this country, beginning with the good burghers of Massachusetts in the 1630s, hadn't invented free public education, people today would say, oh, my God, free public education, that's crazy. We can't afford that. And it seems to me we can't afford not to do it. And now we have a good macroeconomic excuse to do it. If we don't increase public spending dramatically, we're going to have a depression, which is a lot worse than spending $50 billion so that every preschooler in America can have child development-oriented early education. So I think it's really interesting. The mindset that, oh my goodness, how can we afford this, is going to very rapidly change to the mindset, what can we do to spare America depression and restore good quality public services while we're at it? This is Obama's challenge, and only a president, someone as gifted as Obama, as a teacher, and God knows this is a teachable moment, can use the power, the moral authority, the explaining power of the presidency to explain to the American people that we are in a crisis, in the same way that a conservative Republican Treasury Secretary decided that we needed to throw $700 billion at banks. We need to spend some money on human needs, and that is the way we will prevent a financial crash from cascading into a very serious recession. Now, that is completely inverting the conventional wisdom, and this is what it's going to take for Obama to have a successful presidency.
So you are choosing to see the economic crisis as an opportunity to change the way we think and operate financially in America when it comes both to finances and when it comes both to the financial sector and to public works, to infrastructure, to education, to service economy, to human services positions. You think this is an opportunity to rethink a whole lot of things?
I think it's not just an opportunity, it's a necessity. And that's the only reason why anybody in mainstream politics would take this seriously. 6 months ago, nobody in mainstream politics would take seriously the idea that we need to throw $700 billion at the banks to bail out their bad decisions. And 6 months ago, no one in mainstream politics would have taken seriously the idea that we need this order of magnitude increase in spending on infrastructure and public services. But these are not ordinary times. And in researching the book, I went back and looked at what Lincoln faced when he came into office and what he was able to do by 1863. I looked at what Roosevelt faced when he took office and what he was able to do by 1933. And, of course, Lincoln and Johnson and the Civil Rights Revolution. And what was interesting about all three presidents was that things that were deemed impossible 6 months earlier were barely adequate 6 months later. And I'm convinced that this is one of those moments, and I'm convinced that Obama has the character, the leadership, the imagination, the intelligence to rise to the moment.
You know, one of the things we haven't talked about is health insurance, which is one of the cornerstones of Obama's campaign, his proposal to reform health insurance. What do you think the odds are that his proposal, as he described it during the campaign, would actually be enacted through Congress?
You know, I'm almost alone on this, so here's what I think. The most urgent things President Obama will have to do in his first 100 days or his first 6 months are to get the financial system back on track and to spend enough money to prevent a crash from turning into a depression, and as part of that, to put a floor under housing prices. I think tactically and legislatively, the worst possible thing he could do would be to put health reform on the front burner. Why? Well, the other tasks are more urgent. If he fails at the other tasks, he will not have much political capital to spend on health insurance. And health reform is one of the most difficult things of all because you have so many entrenched interests who like things the way they are. You're going up against very powerful industries. So if I were advising Obama, and I'm not an advisor to Obama. The only advice I'm tendering to Obama is the advice in the book, where I argue that he should wait a year and build up some political capital, build up some prestige, get political credit for having prevented a depression, and then in year two or year three, use some of that political capital to really push for transformative health reform.
You would like to see Obama be what you describe as a transformative president mm-hmm. in the manner that FDR was. What are some of the ways that Roosevelt got backing, capital, from the American people and from the Congress to do the kind of economic reforms that he managed to put through during his presidency?
You know, Hoover had the same crisis for 3.5 years, from October 29 through March of 33, that Roosevelt had. But Roosevelt had an optimism. He had an unbelievably magnificent ability to teach, to lead by teaching. His first fireside chat, first week in office, was on the banking crisis. And it's one of the great speeches of all time. He explained to the people in terms that they understood, without being condescending, what had gone on with banks, why he felt the need to temporarily close the banks, the so-called bank holiday, while the government sorted out good banks from bad banks. And he then said to the people, you need to do your part. You need to trust that things are going to get better. And instead of withdrawing money from banks and deepening the crisis of banks going broke, you need to put your money back into banks. And he was so compelling that on Monday morning, people lined up outside the banks, and for the first time in the whole crisis, they lined up to put money back into banks, $300 million that first day, rather than take banks money out. So he had the ability to inspire. He had the ability to lead. He listened to lots of different advisors, and then he went for the bold stroke, and he demonstrated tangible progress. You know, within 6 months, he was creating lots and lots of jobs to put people back to work. And even though the Depression dragged on for another 6 years, there was the sense that help was on the way.
Robert Kuttner, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Robert Kuttner is the author of Obama's Challenge. He's a co-founder and co-editor of the magazine The American Prospect. President-elect Barack Obama has plenty enough to do to ready himself for Inauguration Day, but if Jay Perini had his way, he'd probably give Obama a copy of his new book, Promised Land. In Promised Land, Perini, who's a novelist, poet, and scholar of American literature, has chosen the 13 books that he thinks are crucial to an understanding of American identity. But critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
This election night, we added a few lines of update to one of our most cherished national myths, the belief that America is a land of limitless opportunity where anybody can become anything. Granted, Ben Franklin could never have imagined a President Barack Obama, but in broad strokes, Obama's story of a hard-won rise from obscurity is as old and as American as our founding father Franklin's own autobiographical tale that begins with him landing in Philadelphia as a nobody, with just a few cents and three puffy rolls in his threadbare pockets. The stories that we tell about ourselves as Americans shape our national identity. That's the self-evident truth of Jay Perini's latest book, Promised Land, subtitled 13 Books That Changed America. Perini's book comes out shrewdly, just in time for what promises to be a season of national self-reflection. in it, he explores not the great American canon, no Moby Dick or Leaves of Grass lurking here, but those works, mostly nonfiction and popular, that help to define or consolidate our idea of what it means to be an American. Of course, as Perini acknowledges, the number 13 is a gimmick, echoing the number of original colonies. In his appendix, he lists 100 additional influential books, and he says even that list could have gone on and on. But given his self-imposed limit, Perini has made mostly thoughtful choices. Franklin's autobiography, The Federalist Papers, Thoreau's Walden, Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. A few of his picks are surprising, but he makes convincing cases for them. Mary Antin's immigrant memoir, The Promised Land, and Dr. Spock's Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care. In every instance, Perini sidesteps the pitfall of a project like this one. That is, feeling obliged to supply plot summaries for those books that lots of Americans once read, but that these days lots of Americans only feel like they've read. Perini's background as a poet comes in handy here. He's able to do justice to the voice, tone, and thesis of, say, a book like W.E.B. Du Bois's The Souls of Black Folks in just a few charged paragraphs. List books, like Perini's, are invitations to readers both to discover new treasures and to quibble. First, the treasures. Perini's haunting discussion of the journals of Lewis and Clark made me not only want to go out and buy a copy, but to grab a canoe and start paddling upstream into the forest primeval. Here's one of the insights Perini offers about the journals. In the tradition of nature writing, Lewis and Clark rank high as practitioners. Their close observation of the Western landscape still inspires awe. They offered the first descriptions of grizzly bears, prairie dogs, antelope, and mountain goats, and, alas, mosquitoes. These moments in the journals dazzled readers and established a mode of reporting about the natural world that persists in writers like Barry Lopez and Gretel Ehrlich. Less reverential, but just as revelatory, is Perini's lively discussion of Dale Carnegie's 1936 blockbuster, How to Win Friends and Influence People, a book, Perini says, that's squarely in the enterprising, small businessman spirit of Franklin's autobiography. Perini also points out that between 1989, when communism failed in Russia, and 1997, Carnegie's self-help tome went through 68 editions in Russia. So the quibble? Jack Kerouac's 1957 run-on monument to his own narcissism, On the Road. I've read it numerous times and remain unmoved. I know there are good reasons for the pick, and Perini makes all the logical arguments, but since he devotes so few chapters to American novels, I would have voted for Gatsby, or even for Dashiell Hammett's great mystery, The Maltese Falcon, given that hard-boiled detective fiction is a homegrown American genre. But Perini's list is his own autocratic creation, not a democracy. Especially at this time in our history, readers will benefit from dipping into Perini's book and reacquainting themselves with the nation's bedrock myths and stories, even as new American stories are about to be written.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Promised Land, 13 Books That Changed America by Jay Perini. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.